The United States and the Fortunes of War. Despite Khomeini's lofty wishes, the fate of the war shifted once more in favour of Iraq. In the third and final stage of the war, between 1985 and 1988, Saddam began for the first time since 1982 a new offensive in which he was not alone. He continued to receive generous funding from the oil-rich countries of the Persian Gulf, as well as Western powers and the Soviet bloc. The Soviet Union, Iraq's chief supplier in the past, initially observed an arms embargo, perhaps in the hope of encouraging Iran's neutrality, if not cooperation, in its increasingly troubled occupation of Afghanistan, and with an eye toward Tudeh's support for the Iranian regime. From 1986, however, the Soviets were back in business supplying their old Iraqi ally. The Iraqi forces, regrouped and refurbished, began firing their Soviet-made Scud missiles with horrifying frequency at Iranian cities, and Iranians retaliated in kind with the North Korean version of Scuds, though theirs were far fewer in numbers. It was a bitter irony that both sides were using Soviet and American weaponry against each other, with no ideological tag attached to the hardware and no scruples on the side of the suppliers. In what came to be known as the War of the Cities, thousands were killed on both sides, and tens of thousands turned into internally displaced refugees. With Mirage fighter bombers purchased from France, Iraqis could reach targets deep inside Iran, and American-made combat helicopters offered them visual advantage on the battlefield. In an increasingly vicious war, both sides had little compunction about harming civilians. In the course of the war, the Iraqis fired more than 300 Scud and other missiles on urban targets in Iran, and Iranians retaliated with more than 70. The exchange of missiles had limited military significance, but its psychological impact on the general public was substantial. For the first time since the early days of the war, ordinary people felt that the war was no longer an affair fought off in the distance, but a tangible reality. Iranians began frantically searching for arms to purchase, not only on the treacherous black market at outrageous prices, but also through state suppliers ranging from China, North Korea, and Libya, which sold them Scud missiles purchased from the Soviet Union, to backdoor deals with the United States and its allies, including Israel, for spare parts and anti-tank weapons. Though much smaller in scale and effectiveness, the Israeli and American weapon consignments that came through Israel with the approval of the Reagan administration, or directly through CIA channels, as it turned out, had a scandalous fallout. Israel's motive was simple. It viewed Saddam's victory a cause for Arab solidarity, and with Saddam at the helm. Given that the Palestinian leadership under Yasser Arafat had shifted sides, from praise for Khomeini in the early days of the revolution to praise for Saddam during the later stages of the war, such a security concern hit closer to home. It is hard, moreover, not to detect in Israel's move a desire to see both sides, Iraq and Iran, militarily exhausted and bankrupt. The US record of support for Saddam's war efforts, however, was far more problematic. It was probably among the most appalling in the history of American aid to villainous dictators. While the hostage crisis was still going on, the Carter administration hinted at thawing diplomatic relations with Iraq, a reversal of a policy that for years had treated the Ba'athists as pariahs. At the outset, this seemed a plausible course to counterbalance Iranian success while returning Iran's anti-Americanism in kind. Yet U.S. support for Ba'athists did not stop at the level of diplomacy. Though the Reagan administration had declared neutrality in the Iraq-Iran war, soon it relapsed into a proactive course, especially after 1984, when the U.S. government began to view Iran's advances as detrimental to American interests in the region. U.S. assistance to Iraq ranged from the direct and indirect sale of weapons and export of raw materials for manufacturing chemical and biological weapons, to extensive sharing of military intelligence, CIA and Pentagon operational support on the battlefield, training of Iraqi military personnel, and vast sums of credit for Iraqi purchases of weapons, agricultural needs, and other necessities, as well as tacit or explicit backing for Iraq in the United Nations and other international forums. Fearing the collapse of the Iraqi regime, Late in 1983, and again in March 1984, two delegations, headed by then US Special Envoy to the Middle East Donald Rumsfeld, visited Baghdad to normalize relations and offer help in Iraq's war efforts. The warming of relations began just at the time when Iraq was extensively using mustard gas and nerve gas against Iranian troops. Iraq's struggle for survival, as Washington expressed it, soon gave rise to officers from the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency making available to the Iraqis satellite and airborne early warning and control, AWACS, intelligence on Iran's troop movements, as well as helping directly with military operations. The U.S. personnel, in effect, helped plan and execute the war on a daily basis and advised Iraqi air attacks and shelling Iranian targets. Assistance from the United States proved essential in destroying much of the Iranian military, which had been built so painstakingly by the Shah with U.S. hardware and technical support. Anxiety over the potential fall of the Iraqi regime went so far as to persuade the United States to bring Iraqi personnel to Fort Bragg in North Carolina, where, among taking other courses, they were trained in insurgency tactics in the event of an Iranian victory. Most controversial was the U.S. role in facilitating Iraq's chemical and biological weapon programs. It has been reported that at least 70 shipments of U.S. raw materials for manufacture of chemical and biological weapons were sent to Iraq between 1984 and 1987. This was in addition to the sale of the same materials from German and British private and government sources. It is difficult to determine how much the U.S. materiel went toward the actual manufacture of Iraqi chemical weapons, but there is little doubt that the United States deemed it unavoidable that the banned weapons be used against Iranian troops. In March 1984, the U.S. delegation to the United Nations even went so far as to collude with Iraq in defeating an Iranian resolution in the Security Council that condemned Iraq's use of chemical weapons on the battlefield. Later, in the wake of the Halabja mass killing in 1988, the Reagan administration woefully pointed the finger of suspicion at Iran, presumably knowing full well the extent of Saddam's Al-Anfal operation and his vengeance toward the Kurdish population. Later in the course of the conflict, the United States also played a pivotal role in the so-called Tanker War of 1984 to 1988, aimed to escort Kuwaiti and later Saudi and Iraqi vessels under the U.S. flag to protect them against Iranian amphibian attacks in the Persian Gulf. The internationally accepted pretext of keeping the shipping lanes open, and hence the supply of oil through the Strait of Hormuz uninterrupted, had the intended effect of providing Iraq and its regional allies with a revenue stream from the sale of their oil for the duration of the conflict, while the revived Iraqi Air Force, with the aid of the Americans and their allies, repeatedly pummeled Iranian oil export terminals on Khag Island. Even U.S. outrage over the Iraqi bombing of the USS Stark on May 17, 1987, which resulted in the loss of 37 American sailors, was contained once Iraq lodged a formal apology admitting its error. By April 1988, U.S. support for Saddam had effectively changed the fortune of the war in favor of Iraq and brought it closer to an end. Had it not been for the United States and its European allies, it may be argued, the war probably would have ended in 1984 or 1985 with a serious weakening or possibly collapse of the Ba'athist regime. The United States' national interests, to some degree, may have vindicated a balancing in the critical struggle between an expansionist and a revolutionary regime with an avowed anti-American ideological bent. Yet, by no stretch of realpolitik, can one vindicate the U.S. condoning of Iraq's use of chemical weapons or coordinating of a counteroffensive by a belligerent maverick whose hands were red with the blood of his own people. Realistic casualty figures for the 8-year war period are difficult to come by. By early 1988, the estimated war casualties had reached at least 300,000 dead on the Iranian side and 250,000 on the Iraqi side. Hundreds of thousands more were injured and disabled in what came to be probably the longest war of the 20th century and one of the most ferocious. Exhausted, demoralized, and internationally isolated, Iran slowly came to realize that it no longer could sustain high casualties and the huge economic costs of the war without the risk of renewed internal dissent. Iraqi missile attacks on Iranian cities added to the public distress, especially when combined with the loss of oil revenue, growing numbers of internal refugees, and troop exhaustion. Equally grave was the possibility of a serious confrontation with the United States in the Persian Gulf, once the tanker war had escalated by early 1988. If not Khomeini himself, some of his advisers in charge of the war, most significantly Rafsanjani, came to realize the long-term dangers of engaging a superpower. The downing of an Iran Air passenger Airbus on July 3, 1988, by the USS Vincennes, a guided missile cruiser, resulting in the loss of 290 civilian lives, was an ominous sign. The incident presumably was caused by the US cruiser mistaking the passenger airliner as an approaching Iranian fighter jet, a questionable judgment, perhaps, given Iran's poor Air Force capabilities at the time and the USS Vincennes's advanced radar and intelligence equipment. The incident, Iran's first and only direct military engagement with the United States, reflected the growing tension that had built up between the two countries ever since the hostage crisis. The United States barely expressed regret for the incident, blaming it on the roguery of the Iran Air pilot. 8 years later, when the United States agreed to pay only minimal reparations to the victims' relatives, this was interpreted as a further mark of the United States trying to humiliate Iran. On July 20, 1988, shortly after the downing of its aircraft, Iran finally accepted the UN Security Council Resolution 598, initially adopted on July 20, 1987, calling for an end to hostilities between Iraq and Iran and the withdrawal of all forces to internationally recognized boundaries without delay. Although the resolution requested the UN Secretary-General to explore the question of entrusting an impartial body with inquiring into responsibilities for the conflict, and although it deplored in strongest terms heavy loss of human life and material destruction, it did not call for any form of war reparation or condemnation of the belligerent party. It went only as far as expressing conviction that a comprehensive, just, honourable, and durable settlement should be achieved between Iran and Iraq. One of the decisions attached to the text of the resolution also expressed deep dismay based on the unanimous conclusion of the specialists that there has been repeated use of chemical weapons against Iranian forces by Iraqi forces, and that civilians in Iran have also been injured by chemical weapons, and that Iraqi military personnel have sustained injuries from chemical warfare agents. By August 20, 1988, although both countries observed a ceasefire on all fronts, Iraq refused to evacuate from the frontier territories it had captured in the last years of the war. That was in clear breach of the resolution's call upon both parties to withdraw all forces to the internationally recognized boundaries without delay. Other articles of the resolution, such as a call on both sides for the release of all prisoners of war, and the demand that the UN Secretary-General facilitate a lasting settlement between the countries, remained unaddressed. As it turned out, the Iraqi regime did not abide by any of the additional terms of the resolution. By 1988, Iran's international isolation, its loss of any strategic advantage over Iraq in the battlefield, and its ineptitude to effectively argue its case, compelled it to accept the ceasefire from a position of weakness, and without any explicit UN recognition of Iraq's belligerence. In a rare admission of remorse, Khomeini declared that he had succumbed to the ceasefire as if drinking a chalice of poison, jam-e-zahr, a tantalizing reference perhaps to Socrates' death when condemned by the Athenian court. Coming from a man who was once a teacher of philosophy in Gom with a passion for Greek philosophers, the phrase contained oblique nuances. Accepting the ceasefire was an admission of humiliating defeat, while defying, as did the Greek philosopher, the morality of might makes right. The sum total of 8 years of suffering and carnage for Iran was not only the loss of territory to Iraq along its western border, but also, more important, succumbing to a ceasefire with an Iraqi tyrant who won the war with the military backing of a superpower. His decision, Khomeini stressed, was in consultation with his trusted advisers, and that he took into account the best interest of the country and the revolution. By God, he went on to say, if it was not because of concerns for all of our credibility, honour and expediency for the cause of Islam and the Muslims, I would have never condoned to this act, since death and martyrdom is sweeter to me. But what alternative do we have but to abide by the divine will? No doubt our heroic and valiant nation has and will abide by it. In future, some individuals may intentionally or unintentionally raise doubt as to the fruit of all the blood and sacrifice. They obviously are unaware of the invisible worlds of the hereafter and of the philosophy of martyrdom. Beyond doubt, the blood of the martyrs is insurance for revolution and Islam. Blessed you, the nation! Blessed you, women and men! Blessed you, the martyrs and the captives, those who are lost in action, and families of the glorious martyrs! And woe on me for being still alive, drinking the poisonous chalice of this resolution! I feel humbled before all the sacrifice and glory of this great nation. Yet no amount of verbiage, sophistry, and emotional manipulation could conceal the magnitude of the disaster for which the guardian jurist of the Islamic Republic was largely responsible. Over a longer historical span, the Iran-Iraq War can be seen as a clash of two ideologies, both manifestations of an evolving modern Middle East. Saddam's Ba'athism had all the symptoms of an extreme state-based pan-Arabism, rooted in the post-World War I territorial settlements, unfulfilled national aspirations, volatility within the Iraqi polity, tensions with the Shi'i and the Kurdish communities of Iraq, and conflict with the neighbouring Iran. The Islamic Revolution, by contrast, was based on a revolutionary ideology, a later phase of a new Islam that rejected, at least on the surface, the secular model of nationalism that for more than a century had transformed the region. On the Iranian side, these revolutionary sentiments were deeply ingrained with patriotic feelings, reaffirming a national identity within its historical boundaries. Once these sentiments acquired an invasive posture, however, outside traditional Iranian borders, beyond Zagros and into the Mesopotamian lowlands, they proved ineffective, despite the shared Shi'i religious heritage of the two countries. As in the past, such ambitions under the Islamic Republic did not, and perhaps could not, bear any fruit. Ethnic loyalties and collective memories played their parts in the Iraq-Iran conflict, but what really fueled the war and enabled both sides to fight long and hard was the availability of economic resources generated in the main by oil revenues, despite the damages to both countries' oil installations. Both regimes were able to quell the opposition and tighten their monopoly of power. In effect, the world's energy needs and the ensuing strategic concerns of Western powers facilitated intervention in the conflict, albeit covertly. Interventions in the conflict secured, first and foremost, the flow of oil through the Persian Gulf, but also aimed to maintain the upper hand in the region against a potential Soviet threat, especially after the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. Yet the war did not settle the main territorial issue that contributed to the prolonged conflict. Sovereignty over Shatt al-Arab remained unresolved, at least officially. The humiliating end to the war, moreover, did not bring down the Iranian regime or even sap the revolutionary zeal of its leadership. In part, this can be explained by an effective purge of Iran's political dissent throughout the war and after. Though never reaching the scale and ferocity of the police state in Saddam's Iraq, silencing domestic opposition in Iran under the pretext of security and war priorities secured the regime enough synergy to last even after the demeaning final settlement. War, in effect, vastly helped the Islamic Republic consolidate its military, propaganda and policing apparatuses, close constitutional loopholes, and increase ideological and economic control over society. In this respect, although the war was a net defeat with huge casualties, material ruination, and temporary territorial loss, it was a blessing in disguise, as was repeatedly acknowledged by the regime's clerical leadership. Irrespective of what the regime claimed as its popular mandate, the experience of the war and memories of sacrifice, life in the trenches, bombing of the cities, rationing, and economic hardship were all ingredients for a trial by fire that contributed to shaping post-revolutionary Iran. On the Iraqi side, the Ba'athist euphoria ended soon in a new disaster. As it turned out, soon after Saddam's armies paraded under the Gadesiyeh victory arch, built in a gruesome design using helmets of perished Iranian troops as decoration, and shortly after he was hailed by the press in the Arab world as a hero, his expansionist ambitions brought about another adventure. Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in August 1990, on another territorial pretext, may in part be attributed to the 6 years of U.S. fraternization with Saddam and accommodation of his ambitions. Even a few weeks before Saddam's onslaught against Kuwait, his financial backer during the war with Iran, he still received indecisive messages from the U.S. State Department, which may well have persuaded him to imagine that this time his adventure would be trouble-free. Avenging defeat at home. The 86-year-old Imam of the Revolution's admitting of even a relative defeat did not come without terrible retaliation against his domestic opponents, real or potential. Unforeseen developments during the last days of the war deepened the regime's fears of renewed discontent, public unrest, and armed rebellion. The humiliating end to the war added an almost psychopathic urgency for another round of purges. A sequence of events taking place in less than a year between the ceasefire in July 1988 and Khomeini's death in June 1989 offers a clue to his motivation, if not a rationale. The systematic execution in secret of at least 4,500 political prisoners through the latter part of 1988 was one manifestation of the regime's insecurity and its unexhausted reservoirs of violence. 4 days after Iran accepted the ceasefire, on July the 26th, 1988, an estimated force of 7,000 Mujahideen Khalq, equipped with heavy weaponry by the Iraqis and based inside Iraq, made a surprise attack 50 miles into the western Iranian province of Kermanshan. Backed by Iraqi air and logistical support, the Mujahideen operation, named Farugh-e-Javidan, Eternal Glory, was meant to liberate Iran from its clerical regime. After a crushing setback in 1982 and a respite in France, the Mujahideen leadership and their loyal comrades in arms took refuge in Saddam's Iraq and settled in a military base they called Camp Ashraf, 67 miles north of Baghdad and 110 miles west of the Iranian frontier. By doing so, the desperate Mujahideen turned into Saddam's pawn, a fifth column of sorts that justified collaboration through a culture of indoctrination and iron-fisted conformity. Hoping to gain further advantage from the Iranian regime while it was down, Saddam let the Mujahideen launch their attack on Iranian soil just after the ceasefire came into effect. The Mujahideen operation, however, proved neither eternal nor glorious. It went terribly wrong. Under international pressure, Saddam was soon obligated to withdraw air cover, exposing the Mujahideen to Iranian fighter jets and soon to the Revolutionary Guard's airborne units landing behind their lines. Cut off from their base and with limited firepower, the inexperienced Mujahideen force was completely routed 4 days after their initial assault. At least 2,000 Mujahideen were killed in action, and reportedly more than 400 Iranian troops and guards perished. To the limited extent that the Mujahideen advanced inside Iran, the civilian population did not receive them as liberators. Nor would they have been accorded a warm reception, given the extensive damage they had inflicted on Shahabad-e-Gharb, now Islamabad-Gharb, the only town they occupied on the Iranian western border. The remnants of the Mujahideen and those who managed to flee back to the Iraqi camp suffered the defeat with pitiful complacency. Irrespective of their defeat, the thrust of the regime's anti-Mujahideen grudge had already resurfaced in mass executions inside the Islamic Republic's prisons. On July the 19th, 1988, on the eve of the ceasefire, and 4 days before the start of the Mujahideen's operation, Khomeini issued a fatwa-like executive order declaring members of the People's Mujahideen already in prisons of the Islamic Republic to be active combatants against Islam, that is, Muharreb, and thus condemnable to death. He justified this extraordinary ruling on the grounds that the hypocrites were not believers in Islam, had committed apostasy, irtidad, had actively engaged in a classic war along Iranian frontiers, had collaborated with the Ba'athist regime and spied for them against our Islamic nation, and were in contact with the universal arrogance, Estekbare Jahani, a reference to the United States and its allies. Despite the Sharia-sounding rationale, Khomeini's instructions were aimed not at the combatants in the battlefields, but at the thousands of political prisoners he stigmatized in his executive order as those insisting on their hypocrisy. The Quranic reference to hypocrites, munafiqin, was a convenient shortcut to a vengeful mass killing. Khomeini's ruling, which must have been in the making for a while, was only reaffirmed by the Mujahideen's action and gave the Khomeinist hardliners an ideal excuse to empty the prisons of thousands of victims. Immediately, a 3-man clerical tribunal appointed by Khomeini and aided by some of his most trusted henchmen meticulously went through the roster of Evin and other prisons and detention centres in Tehran and the provinces, selecting and segregating thousands of suspects, both men and women. They were individually brought before a tribunal to answer a set of questions, and though this action appeared to be consistent with the Islamic law of apostasy, it was in fact a sinister ploy to remove almost any chance of acquittal for the victims. Many of the suspects, teenagers or in their early 20s, had been arrested years earlier and had already been tried and given prison sentences. They were originally accused of such crimes as being members of the Mujahideen and Fadayan, distributing their tracts, attending demonstrations, sympathizing with the left, and other charges entirely inconsistent with the charge of apostasy, or actively warring against Islam or collaboration with the enemy. Even some of the most ardent repentants, Tawabin, who were re-educated in prison and actively practicing Islamic rituals under the watchful eyes of the prison's ideological religious commissars, or inmates who had completed their terms or were near completion, were not spared. Unaware of why they were brought before the tribunal, or unaware of the charges, the defendants had to confirm or deny belief in Islam, whether they were practicing Muslims, if they were prepared to reveal the identity of other hypocrites, sympathizers, and false repentants, if they were willing to go before television cameras to repent, and if they were prepared to fight on the front and pass over minefields. After the first or the second question, usually, the tribunal passed its judgment. Victims were then asked to write their last will and immediately were sent off in groups of 6 to the gallows. In compliance with Islamic law, in most cases the victims were hanged so that they would suffer a slow death rather than going before a firing squad. Most victims were the Mujahideen and their sympathizers, followed by the Fadayan, the Tudeh, Pekar, and other leftist parties. Female members of the Mujahideen and other parties were forced to repent, severely beaten, received a lashing, and were kept in solitary confinement. A few were executed or died under torture. In the nearly 6 months between July and December 1988, executions went on around the clock and almost in total secrecy. The regime's denial of any executions was only occasionally countered by the pleas of anxious but terrified families, who were banned even from gathering before the prison gates. Bodies of the victims were not returned to their relatives, contrary to usual practice in the Islamic Republic of returning slaughtered bodies in exchange for the price of bullets. Those executed in the Evin prison were dumped in secrecy in mass graves in an undisclosed location in the vicinity of the capital. The location of the graves, which the regime dubbed Kofrabad, abode of infidelity, and La Nat Abad, abode of damnation, were revealed to the families only a year later. They were permitted to visit the ramshackle site only if they observed a total ban on memorial gatherings of any sort. In the cemetery in southwestern Tehran, later known as Khavaran, the mass graves of the 1988 victims were shared with graves of the Baha'is, the other infidels of the Islamic Republic. Even as late as 2009, the regime's anxieties were not entirely abated. Khavaran was bulldozed so as to remove even the makeshift marks made by the families of the dead. These were Iran's other sites of memory, unmarked and unattended. The executions elicited virtually no criticism within the regime's inner circles, except for one important exception, Ayatollah Hussein Ali Montazeri, and he paid dearly for raising his voice. The majority of high-ranking mullahs and their associates who were aware of the mass killings, or came to know of them in the following months, were either in favour of this atrocity or did not dare to raise an objection. The rotating membership of the Death Committee, as the three-man tribunal came to be known, included some of the most notorious revolutionary judges and perpetrators of political crimes in the Islamic Republic. Their verdicts, grounded in a meticulous reading of Khomeini's directive, revealed a culture of brutality at odds with the idealized image of Khomeini as the kind-hearted father of the revolution. Like the massacre of the Banu Qurayza in 7th century Medina, which Khomeini was fond of recalling as a model for dealing with charges of treason, the judges saw no grounds for mercy or fairness. Baha'is as the other. Aside from political opponents, the Islamic Republic, and more specifically its anti-Baha'i activists, continued to harass and persecute Baha'is. In the months following the victory of the revolution, other non-Muslim communities, Jews, Armenians, and Zoroastrians, as well as Sunni Muslims, Sufis, the Al-e-Haq, and Sheikhis, did not remain untouched by the new regime's rigorous segregationist policies. Non-Muslims were banned from government employment, their community school curricula were Islamicized, community activities controlled, and for a while Jews were banned from travelling abroad. The thrust of this systematic persecution, however, was directed against the devious sect, Fergeye Zaleh, a familiar euphemistic label for the Baha'is. The renewed persecution was a culmination of anti-Baha'i sentiments common to Iranian society since the very inception of the new faith in the mid-19th century. In the first decade of the Islamic Republic, more than 200 Baha'i women and men were executed, not only elected members of Baha'i national and local administrative bodies, but ordinary Baha'is in towns and villages around the country. They were executed merely for being Baha'i. Others were abducted and killed in secret. Ali Morad Davoudi, 1922-1979, a professor of philosophy at Tehran University and a Cartesian of some repute, was abducted and killed in November 1979 after he penned a succinct response to anti-Baha'i smears. Manoucher Hakim, 1910-1981, a professor of medicine at Tehran University and a pioneer of free medical clinics, was attacked and slaughtered in his office. Among those executed between February 1980 and June 1981, either by order of the revolutionary courts or without any court proceedings, were Jinous Mahmoudi, 1925-1981, dean of Iran's School of Meteorology, her husband Hushang Mahmoudi, a well-known TV personality of children's programs, and a number of lawyers, physicians, career engineers and contractors, army officers, as well as homemakers. Among numerous executions ordered by the revolutionary courts was the case of the Baha'i women of Shiraz. In June 1983, 10 Baha'i women in that city, mostly in their 20s, were arrested on the charge of teaching principles of their faith to Baha'i children in Friday classes held in houses of the Baha'is. They were summarily tried, and despite excessive pressure, they refused to repent their faith. They were condemned of being agents of the Zionists' entity and executed. Before execution, some were reportedly raped in prison on the grounds that the Shi'i Sharia requires, as the revolutionary judge interpreted it, that virgins be deflowered before execution so as to prevent their salvation in the hereafter. The head of the Shiraz Revolutionary Court, a certain Hajjat al-Islam Ghazai, later implied in a newspaper interview that he condemned to death 22 Baha'i women and men because they remained steadfast in their faith. He threatened that all deviant Baha'is must repent if they wish to avoid Muslims' religious obligation to destroy all infidels. Altogether, in the first decade of the Islamic Republic, upward of 200 Baha'is were executed, and thousands more in urban and rural communities throughout Iran were imprisoned and tortured. Tens of thousands were harassed, looted, purged from government posts, barred from universities, had their livelihoods confiscated by the revolutionary courts, were forced to repent their faith under duress, lost their retirement pensions, or were forced out of their towns and villages. As the largest non-Muslim community in Iran, Baha'is had a remarkable nationwide geographical and class distribution that included villages, some established at the inception of the Babi movement in remote regions, residents of small towns and working classes in large cities, teachers, bureaucrats, small business owners, as well as professionals and members of the affluent middle classes. The Islamic Revolution had been a major blow to the community as a whole. While many, including most affluent Baha'is, soon emigrated to Europe and North America, others, mostly lower-income Baha'is, stayed behind only to face increasing restrictions and humiliation. Vile anti-Baha'i campaigns in the press and media, lies and fabrications in history textbooks, economic loss and general social demotion were accompanied by losses of educational opportunities for the younger generations. The unaccredited Baha'i Institute of Higher Education in Tehran, a semi-clandestine institution but effective in countering the official ban on higher education for Baha'is, faced repeated onslaughts by security forces. Bans on Baha'i administration, public gatherings and publications, as well as the destruction of Baha'i cemeteries all over Iran and the confiscation, desecration and demolition of sacred and historic Baha'i sites, among them the best-preserved examples of Qajar domestic architecture, all became everyday facts of life. These actions represented a program of intolerance and intimidation aimed at suffocating to extinction a community considered by the Islamic Republic heretical and treasonous. Despite all pressures, few among the Iranian Baha'is denied their religious identity. Baha'is did not present a political threat to the Islamic Republic. Yet they were increasingly perceived as a potent internal enemy, especially when other political contenders had been effectively quashed. Accusations against them followed a historical pattern. Whereas in earlier times the charges were mostly of heresy and apostasy, by the mid-20th century the accusations had become exceedingly political and conspiratorial. In earlier times, the old charge of sexual revelry, especially clandestine sexual transgressions, abaha, was levelled against them. This was a smear as old as the history of persecuted Jewish, Christian, and Manichaean minorities in ancient times. Even early Islamic societies accused nonconformists of forbidden sexual transgressions. Popularized relics of such smears found a new lease of life in the fertile imagination of the anti-Baha'i polemicists. Yet even the charge of immorality gradually faded, giving way to charges of disloyalty, spying, and treason. Political allegations were the byproduct of a climate of paranoid fears and conspiracy theories, an obsession with the hidden hand of European colonialism. In this representation, Baha'is were viewed as puppets of a sinister Western power whose identity kept evolving with time. One prevalent narrative, originating in the 1930s, was presented in the form of a fraudulent memoir of a Russian diplomat, Prince Dolgorukiy, a composite figure of a sort, attributing the creation of the Baha'i pseudo-religion to Russian imperial ambitions in the 19th century. Later, however, the same narrative was amended by a new epilogue in which the Russian imperialists, once they no longer had a use for the Baha'is, generously handed over control of them to British colonialists. Given the potency of British hidden hands in the Iranian popular imagination, such a charge carried grave consequences throughout the 1950s and 1960s. Yet the evolutionary mutation in the life of this deception did not end with the British. In the 1960s, Baha'is were further accused of being not merely British lackeys, but simultaneously agents in the service of US imperialism and the CIA. And soon after, coinciding with the Islamic Revolution and the rise of anti-Zionist sentiments, as agents and spies of world Zionism. The latter allegation brought many Baha'is, men and women, before the revolutionary courts even in remote towns and villages of Iran and led to numerous executions and long-term imprisonment during the first decade of the revolution and later. That the Baha'i World Center and Baha'i sacred sites were located in Haifa and Acre, in today's Israel, itself the outcome of a long-term banishment of Baha'u'llah, founder of the Baha'i faith, to Ottoman Palestine 7 decades before the creation of the State of Israel, was more than sufficient proof in the eyes of its accusers of Baha'i complicity in a British-American Zionist collusion. Somehow they were all instruments of the sinister colonialists and agents of a global ploy hatched by universal arrogance to destroy the Islamic Republic and Islam as a whole. If further proof was needed, the accusers could always resort to the record of the Baha'i leader, Mirza Abbas Nouri, better known as Abdul Baha, who in 1921 accepted British knighthood, presumably for his peace efforts toward the success of Allied operations in Palestine following the collapse of the Young Turks regime and the end to their atrocities in Syria and Palestine. In the eyes of the Islamic Republic, this was tantamount to Baha'i subservience to British imperialism and later to the Zionist entity, as Israel was referred to in the Islamic Republic. The Baha'i experience in the Pahlavi era exposed the community's own shortcomings to communicate more effectively with Iranian society at large. Throughout the post-constitutional period and into the early Pahlavi era, a sector of the urban Baha'is excelled in socio-economic terms, in part because of decreased harassment and discriminations. They also advanced because they were welcomed into a benign partnership in the early Pahlavi project of modernity and were part of its flourishing middle classes. Yet, with time, the Baha'is gradually lost much of their appeal as harbingers of religious modernity. Relative prosperity brought social isolation from society at large. Success, empowered by education and capital, widened the gulf between Baha'is and traditional Muslim sectors and sharpened differences with Islamic opponents. Both the clergy and anti-Baha'i activists, such as the Hojatiyeh Society, bemoaned the Baha'is' acquired freedoms to preach their message, limited though they were. In effect, their enemies viewed Baha'is as a new challenge to Islamic superiority. The Hojatiyeh Society, perhaps the largest Islamic organization before the revolution, was almost solely devoted to anti-Baha'i activities. Yet heated engagements with Islamic clergy and lay activists over arcane points of theology and acrobatics of messianic prophecies not surprisingly made the Baha'i message stagnant and their approach outmoded and intellectually timid. Because the Baha'is maintained a doctrine of political non-interference, a relic of the 19th century, they were unfairly suspected as complacent, even collaborating with the Pahlavi regime. By the mid-1970s, like any other isolated minority under a repressive regime, the Baha'is were accused of monopolizing key positions in the Pahlavi regime. The Premier Amir Abbas Hovedar, in particular, was rumored to be a Baha'i only because at some stage in the distant past his father, an Iranian diplomat, was a member of the Baha'i community, though he later withdrew from it altogether. Baha'is were accused of pulling the strings, running the Savak and torturing its victims, monopolizing wealth and privilege through their intimate connections with sources of power, and liaising in dirty deals with the British intelligence services, the CIA, and the Israelis. Venomous rumors such as these thrived in the late Pahlavi era, while Baha'is carefully tried to stay away from the raging flames of the revolutionary movement. Under the Islamic Republic, these rumors were quickly upgraded to unquestionable facts and turned into evidence for charges of treason and conspiracy. Deeper than doctrinal differences or conspiratorial obsessions, however, antagonism toward the Baha'i was representative of a shared heritage, not only among Islamists, but also among many intellectuals on the left, academics, and the public at large. The search for an enemy within, on whose shoulder could be placed all the faults of the past and fears for the future, was an exercise in self-indulgence familiar to cultures of victimization. The Baha'is were cohesive and resilient, but increasingly introverted. Standing their ground and refusing to doctrinally assimilate made them a target of suspicion and animosity. If the revolutionary regime in its quixotic battle could no longer defeat the great Satan, it could harass a vulnerable enemy within. Deal with the Great Satan. Revelations in November 1986 concerning an Iranian arms deal with the United States, using Israel as an intermediary, triggered a full-scale political scandal between August 1985 and March 1987 in Washington, known as the Iran-Contra affair, with serious repercussions for the Reagan administration. The course of events that shaped the affair exhibited how the United States, despite a history of rancorous relations with Iran, was prepared to engage Iran by supplying it with arms and spare parts, albeit for its own covert operation. Even more troubling was the fact that despite the Islamic Republic's public denouncement of Israel, it had no compunction in using Israel as an intermediary in the arms deal, all the while persecuting Baha'is in towns and villages of Iran on charges of espionage for the great Satan and the Zionist entity. In the years leading to Iran-Contra, Iran was enlisted by the United States among the rogue states sponsoring terrorism and subject to an arms embargo and other sanctions. The secret arms deal thus promised to provide Iran with much-needed material in the war with the minor Satan, as Saddam ranked in the demonology of the Islamic Republic. Whatever the Reagan administration's justifications for the arms deal with Iran, including raising funds needed for a covert operation against Nicaragua, facilitating the release of American hostages who were in the custody of the Hezbollah of Lebanon, and a goodwill gesture with the remote hope of rekindling relations with revolutionary Iran, the initiative eventually backfired. It blew up into a major embarrassment on several counts and received enormous publicity worldwide. In addition to breaching the arms sanctions against Iran, the White House security advisor stood accused of breaking a congressional ban on assistance to Contra forces fighting the Nicaraguan revolutionary regime. The Iranian side of the deal was arranged by a shady Iranian arms dealer, Manoucher Ghorbanifar, born 1945, once a SAVAK agent and partner in an Israeli-Iranian shipping company. He claimed to have contacts with influential moderates in the Iranian regime. On the American side was maverick staff member of the National Security Council, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, born 1946. The prospect of reopening relations with Iran was intriguing to the American administration. Not only the National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane, born 1943, but also the CIA chief William Casey, as well as other senior White House officials and President Reagan himself, were optimistic enough to approve the sale of more than 2,500 American-made TOW anti-tank missiles to Iran over 2 years. The Israelis delivered early consignments of missiles and spare parts after they scratched off the tracing numbers and Hebrew letters, presumably saving the Iranian regime from the embarrassment of sending Israeli equipment to their warriors in the battlefields of the good versus the evil, as war with Iraq was labeled in the Iranian revolutionary propaganda. From the outset, Iranians had no illusions as to where the weapons had originated and at what overblown price. Later consignments were directly shipped from the United States. Encouraged by the release of some hostages in Lebanon through Iranian mediation, the Reagan administration was thrilled enough to dispatch to Iran in May 1986 a mission headed by McFarlane and including North, a host of other American officials, and Amiram Nir, 1950-1988, the chief Israeli agent in charge of the deal. They were aboard an Israeli aircraft that also carried a plane load of missiles and military spare parts for delivery to Iran. Upon arrival in Tehran, the uninvited mission soon realized they were unwelcome. Even a copy of the Bible signed by the US president as a goodwill gesture and a cake brought over in the shape of a key did not open any friendly doors. The mission returned to the United States hastily and in disgrace. What was remarkable about the whole affair was the degree of naivete displayed by the White House in assessing the complexity of the Iranian situation and its predicament. It was even more curious that Americans assumed that Iranians would not see through so obvious a ploy as luring Iran to normalization, when at the very same time the U.S. administration, as part of its two-track policy, was offering military assistance and reconnaissance to Saddam's Iraq. Under such circumstances, it was quite possible that Iranians, even the moderates imagined by the arms-selling intermediary, were not prepared to risk years of investing in the Great Satan rhetoric, a cornerstone of Islamic Republic's international posture, for the sake of an arms deal with a superpower clearly opposed to their ideological standing. They were willing to purchase arms from the United States and Israel so long that things stay at that level. What was also remarkable was how shrewdly the leadership of the Islamic Republic managed to waive the scandalous after-effects of Iran-Contra. The fact that Iran struck a secret deal with the great Satan, and even with the Zionist entity, was no small matter at a time when echoes of death to America and death to Israel were audible in every Friday prayer throughout Iran. Such temerity was typical of the regime's political culture. Any regime, it may be argued, in the throes of a deadly war, would strike a deal with a power capable of delivering the necessary hardware. Yet purchasing arms from the United States and Israel to fight a Muslim neighbour could be swallowed by the Iranian public only with a great deal of ideological grease, as when only a few years earlier, in 1982, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon claimed 80,000 Shi'i Lebanese and Palestinian victims. Concerned with the damage that exposure of the arms deal can cause, in September 1987, the Iranian security forces arrested Mehdi Hashemi, 1946-1987, a close aide to Montazeri and in control of a militia loyal to him, on the charge of treason. A seminarian of militant convictions and a lifetime client of Montazeri, Hashemi in 1977 was tried in a Pahlavi court and sentenced to life imprisonment on the charge of assassinating a prominent Ayatollah in Isfahan. Hashemi was the ringleader of a terrorist group known as the Hadafis, those who believed in Shi'ism's political objective, which was inspired by the publication of a controversial book, Shahid e Javid, The Eternal Martyr. It argued that Hossein, the third Shi'i imam, sacrificed himself for a proactive political cause rather than sheer moral endeavour. After the victory of the revolution and release from prison, Hashemi gravitated toward the idea of exporting the revolution, and especially to Shi'i communities abroad, which in turn drew him into the factional politics of the then-evolving Lebanese Hezbollah. Opposed to the secret arms deal with the United States in exchange for the release of American hostages in Lebanon, Hashemi disclosed the secret deal to the Lebanese weekly, Ashira. Outraged by the imminent disclosure, in October 1986, the Iranian security forces arrested Hashemi and 40 of his associates shortly before the publication of the damaging revelations in Ashira on November 3, 1986. After lengthy detention, torture, and a forced television interview in which he confessed to his crime of collaborating with the great Satan, Hashemi was eventually put on trial in the clergy's special court. He was executed in November 1987. Silencing Hashemi, and in turn Montazeri, only partially diverted the bewildered Iranian public. Other pretexts were needed to distract attention to another direction. It was not mere coincidence, therefore, that at the tail end of the Iran-Contra affair, and shortly after Hashemi's execution, Khomeini should engage in a seemingly unnecessary crisis. What came to be known as the Rushdie affair inflicted further damage to Iran's already battered image abroad, yet it handsomely paid off, saving Khomeini's image at home as an uncompromising Islamic crusader. On February 14, 1989, he issued a famous fatwa accusing Salman Rushdie, the British writer of Muslim Indian descent and author of The Satanic Verses, of blasphemy. The fatwa called on all valiant Muslims to kill the author and all the editors and publishers who were aware of the novel's content, wherever they found them and without delay, so that no one will dare insult the sacred beliefs of Muslims henceforth, and whoever is killed in this cause will be a martyr. The fatwa, while elevating post-war turmoil inside Iran to a new height, also triggered a wave of condemnation in the West toward Khomeini and his Islamic regime. From the perspective of Khomeini and his officials and aides, who in the days following the issuance of the fatwa announced a $6 million award for Rushdie's assassination, the fatwa was an affordable tool of brandishing the regime's comparative brand in a fast-growing international market of Islamic militancy, even if the cost would be a break in diplomatic relations with Britain, where Rushdie was residing. Less than 4 months before Khomeini's death from terminal cancer, which had already been diagnosed at the time, one might attribute his stirring up the Rushdie controversy primarily to leave behind a legacy of unbending militancy. The grievous end to the war and the unravelling of his vision to export the revolution may well have given him the impression that condemning Rushdie would ensure his legacy. Placing himself in a primary role in the anti-Rushdie protest movement that stretched from Britain to Pakistan and beyond guaranteed that. As he saw it, in the scheme of things, the issuance of a death fatwa was a religious duty, especially when coming from the guardian jurist of the Islamic Republic. Jumping on the bandwagon of anti-Rushdie mania, no doubt, also secured the intended publicity at home as well. A hefty award brazenly placed on Rushdie's head gave the affair an extra flavour of bounty-hunting justice. Whatever the offensive content of the novel, The Satanic Verses, the fatwa constituted serious harassment of a gifted writer with great cultural sensibilities. It also undermined provisions in Islamic law regarding cases of blasphemy and the evidentiary and procedural grounds for issuing a legal opinion. For one thing, it can be argued that a work of fiction with a phantasmagoric style and with such ambiguous characters as the story's Mahound can hardly be accepted as evidence for blasphemy. According to such a yardstick, many Sufi aphorisms and some in the corpus of Persian and Arabic poetry would be heretical. It is also debatable whether the penal provisions of Islamic law are binding by anyone beyond the jurisdiction of Dar al-Islam, if for no other reason than that the accused must first be brought before a Sharia court presided over by one or more jurists who are qualified to study the text in question, or rely on unbiased and trusted experts. By calling on the brave Muslims of the world, it was as if Khomeini instantaneously expanded the abode of Islam globally, a trend that was soon to be emulated by Muslim militants everywhere. Yet there is near consensus that no opinion can be issued by an Islamic court before the accused is cross-examined in person, admitting or denying a charge of blasphemy brought against him or her. The text by itself, according to most jurists, does not carry sufficient weight for the issuance of a fatwa of blasphemy, let alone a death sentence, the execution of which, at any rate, cannot be delegated to an anonymous individual. That the author apologized or repented did not alter Khomeini's or his clerical followers' opinions, even though an overwhelming majority of Muslim jurists admit that repentance for first-time offenders is adequate grounds for recalling a death sentence, even in grave blasphemy cases. Khomeini's fatwa thus appeared to be serving other purposes than a mere discharge of juristic obligation, given the glaring legal breaches that must have been known to him and his cohorts. That the intense publicity in the Iranian media portrayed publication of Satanic Verses as a Western conspiracy against Islam, moreover, pointed to a skillful masking of the realities of the post-war era. The gloomy realities included the return home of hundreds of thousands of disillusioned and disabled war veterans, rows of graves in overcrowded martyr ceremonies, tens of thousands of detainees kept in ghastly Iraqi prisoner of war camps, and difficulties in fulfilling promises made to families of martyrs. The anti-Rushdie crusade also served to soften contention within the leadership at a critical juncture when Khomeini's death loomed large. The designation of the next guardian jurist appeared to be in trouble. Dismissal of the designated heir. The state-sponsored public clamour demanding Rushdie's assassination was loud enough to swamp Montazeri's call for moderation. In an atmosphere of adulation for the great leader and an imagined Western conspiracy to blemish and ridicule Islam, Montazeri dared to say that the people of the world thought of Iran as just in the business of killing people. No other ranking clergy raised any concern, at least in public, over the validity of Khomeini's fatwa, let alone concern with free speech or Iran's image abroad. As in the case of the 1988 executions, here too, bowing blindly before the guardian jurist had become a norm in the Islamic Republic with no parallel in the Shi'i past, and for good reason, as Montazeri's fate soon demonstrated. As designated heir, Janishin, to the imam, and probably the most prominent jurist in Khomeini's inner circle, and an early advocate of Velayat-e Faqih, Montazeri has kept a healthy distance from the internal quarrels and controversial decisions. Earlier, he had criticized the way the hardliners shunned Bazargan and his colleagues as compromising liberals, and in 1981 he even attempted, unsuccessfully, to broker peace with the Mujahideen. In his typical plain language, he occasionally mentioned the regime's harsh treatment of his opponents, touching at times innocuously on Khomeini's positions. In turn, he was gradually cut off from the decision-making circle around the imam of the revolution. Equally worrisome was the regime's fear of a domestic source of dissent similar to the leftist militias and close to the mujahideen's anti-clerical positions, especially if it had the blessing of an important clerical authority such as Montazeri. His implicit rebuke of how revolutionary ideals were being compromised with the growth of financial corruption in high circles and widespread political repression added to the rift. Already distraught by Hashimi's execution, by mid-1988, Montazeri was voicing his abhorrence at the reports of mass executions of political prisoners. In a number of cautionary notes addressed to Khomeini, he considered such killings neither consistent with the Sharia nor justified by human rights standards. He openly reiterated his earlier demands to reassess failures of the revolution and open up the political space, demands that stood little chance of seeing Khomeini's compliance. This was the first and the only public confirmation of the mass killings coming from a senior figure. Coinciding with the anti-Rushdie campaign came the revelation of Montazeri's note to Khomeini, dating August 1, 1988, cautioning against prison executions on Islamic and human rights grounds. "About your honour's recent order pertaining to the execution of the hypocrites, that is, the mujahideen, who are already in prisons," wrote Montazeri, "the execution of those who were detained after the recent incident, that is, Mujahideen's offensive in western Iran in July 1988. Nation and the society will accept it, and apparently it will not have a negative repercussion. But executing those who were already in prisons beforehand, first of all, will be interpreted under the present circumstances as an act of vengeance and reprisal. What have we gained so far from killings and violence, except increasing adverse publicity against ourselves, while adding to the appeal of the hypocrites and anti-revolutionaries? It is now the time to act for a while with compassion and benevolence." By early 1989, Montazeri had gone so far as to implicitly criticize Khomeini in public for denying people their rights and disregarding the revolution's true values. He called on the leader to allow for a political and ideological reassessment. By the standards of the Islamic Republic, this was an unprecedented reproach of Khomeini and his radical allies. Montazeri's revelation and criticisms of the Guardian jurist predictably further enraged Khomeini and vexed his associates, among them Sayyid Ali Khamenei, president of the Islamic Republic since 1981 and soon to be supreme leader of the Republic, an enforcer of Khomeini's whims and wishes, and the chief implementer of Khomeini's war strategy. He appeared to have been instrumental in staging the last scene of the anti-Montazeri coup de grace. The Council of Experts, entirely peopled by ranking mullahs loyal to Khomeini, had already begun revisiting the qualifications for the Guardian jurist in the Islamic Republic's constitution while contemplating the choice of the next leader. By March 1989, when Khomeini openly disowned Montazeri, his once close comrade, it was more for public consumption than to alert the Council of Experts of Montazeri's undesirability. On March 28, 1989, 2 days after a taunting speech by Khomeini, Montazeri quietly resigned. He also accepted with dignity the restrictions placed on him by the regime for the following 2 decades of his life. Residing in his house in Gome, he continued teaching a small circle of students and gave occasional interviews before his statements subjected him to house arrest and a complete ban on interviews. Not long afterward, he was erased, not unlike in the Soviet Union of the Stalin era, entirely from public view and the official revolutionary narrative. During Mohammad Khatami's presidency, 1997 to 2005, his house arrest was partially relaxed, though he remained an outsider, deprived of public speeches, travel, and publication of any political statement. Contesting the restrictions despite his ailments, he expressed views and issued opinions antithetical to some repressive policies of the regime and reflective of his moderating outlook. His reissuance of a fatwa in May 2008, in response to renewed persecutions of Baha'is of Iran, reflected Montazeri's courageous stance. The members of the Baha'i sect, he stressed, don't have a divine scripture and are not considered a religious minority, but since they are citizens of this country, they have indigenous rights, Hage Ab Vagel, and are entitled to rights of citizenship. Moreover, they should benefit from Islamic compassion as emphasized in the Quran and by guardians of our faith. His death on December 19, 2009, stirred much public sympathy in Tehran, Qom, Isfahan, and elsewhere. Coming in the aftermath of the June 2009 Green Movement, the regime imposed a near-total ban on any commemorative gathering. Montazeri's fall was the last of the purges of Khomeini's era and emblematic of the Islamic Republic's relentless quest for regimented uniformity. That the clerical establishment, with few exceptions, rallied behind Khomeini on this issue was not merely due to a climate of coercion and a demand for total loyalty. The ruling clergy was also responsible for trading its customary judicial and academic autonomy in exchange for new privileges under the Republic's hierarchy. They took advantage of the opportunity to monopolize political power and solidify privileges at the price of depreciating ijtihad as a tool of judicial independence. Slavish subservience to velayat-e faqih superseded even the authority of marjaiyat. End of an era. On June 3, 1989, Ayatollah Khomeini died of terminal cancer at the age of 87. His funeral brought hundreds of thousands of mourners into the streets of the capital, along the road to his burial place 15 miles south of Tehran on the road to Qom. A memorable event in the calendar of the Islamic Revolution, crowds of mourners were comparable in size only to Khomeini's reception upon arrival from exile a decade earlier. The two events, in effect, marked the beginning and the end of the first phase of the Islamic Revolution, during which Khomeini's leadership was central and enduring. The mourners, spontaneous in their emotions and visibly overcome with grief, brought the funeral to a standstill, broke through the procession, and struggled to reach the casket and touch Khomeini's shroud. The pandemonium that followed long delayed the interment. The outpouring of emotions carried an underlying message. It was as if the public were not only mourning the loss of the Imam, but also burying with Khomeini's remains the revolutionary passions that had motivated a generation, brought people into the streets, and forever transformed Iranian society. It was a subtle message from an exhausted public to leave behind protest rallies and sacrifice in the battlefield and move ahead toward greater normalcy. Even Khomeini's mausoleum, hastily designed and hurriedly built, seemed to carry a message of finality. The gilded dome, minarets, the inner structure, zari, and the niche, mihrab, clearly called for a return to the sacred Shi'i past. At the terminus of a Tehran underground line, the Imam's mausoleum seemed to emphasize, symbolically, an end point along the revolution's mental itinerary. The building, in effect, beatifies Khomeini in a space meant to be superior to the nearby Shah Abd al-Azim shrine, and on par with such sites as the shrines of Qom and even Mashhad. It also was a symbolic reference, albeit in reverse, to the demolished Reza Shah mausoleum that had once been located not far away. The inscription above an entrance to the interior of the mausoleum carries a short passage from Khomeini's Political Divine Testament. It assures visitors, "By God's grace, it is with a serene soul, a confident heart, an elated spirit, and a hopeful conscience that I now bid farewell to my sisters and brothers and travel to my eternal resting place." It is quite remarkable that being for a decade at the helm of a ferocious course of events that claimed hundreds of thousands of lives in the battlefields, in prisons, and on the streets, the guardian jurist of the revolution could still entertain such cheerful aspirations. With the benefit of hindsight, it is possible to say that by 1989, the charismatic phase of the revolution had decidedly come to an end. During the decade under Khomeini, the revolution effectively dismantled not only the Pahlavi political and technocratic elites, but also a large sector of the Pahlavi middle classes. During the same period, the new regime effectively suppressed competing sources of dissent, from the radical left to liberals and clerical moderates, and regional and ethnic resistance. Despite serious setbacks, It also managed to deter a formidable aggressor in neighbouring Iraq, while taking on a superpower, the United States, in an egregious, though largely symbolic, contest. Through the hostage crisis and war with Iraq, and a host of other challenges, the Islamic Republic under Khomeini solidified its base and created political and security institutions to preserve its economic and financial monopolies. Like a host of 20th-century revolutionary leaders, from Lenin and Mao to Ho Chi Minh, and possibly even Gandhi, Khomeini was crucial in the shaping of a mass revolution. His prophetic acumen, however, neither entirely replicated the revolutionary and messianic examples of the past, nor was a mere byproduct of modern ideologies and their post-colonial reverberations. He relied instead on a normative Islam and the clerical establishment that represented it. Ruthless and resolute, he successfully transformed the Sharia-based clerical establishment into a powerful tool to mobilize the less privileged sectors of society, without ever fully breaking from traditional Islamic values or offering a coherent program of socio-economic and cultural change. His fascination with an idealized and largely ahistorical true Islam, though not entirely devoid of elements of modernity, remained by and large regressive in its outlook and conduct. Khomeini's most tangible and enduring contribution, however, was his success in putting into practice the long-speculated-on idea of political Islam. The Islamic Republic that he helped found was the first to emerge out of an ideological revolution, something that perhaps could emerge only in Shi'i Iran. Yet as a militant and a revolutionary promoting the paradigm of an Islamic state, Khomeini's influence has been well evident throughout the Muslim world since the 1980s. In that regard, at least, in modern times, no other Muslim thinker, activist, or revolutionary can match his record. Irrespective of their brand of Islamic activism, it can be argued that none of the modern Muslim thinkers and revolutionaries, from Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab in the 18th century to Jamal ad-Din Asadabadi and Muhammad Abdu in the 19th century to Rashid Reza, Hassan al-Banna, Sayyid Qutb, and Abul Ala Maududi in the 20th century, are comparable to Khomeini insofar as their regional or global impact. At least three characteristics qualify the Islamic Revolution as a major revolutionary movement in modern times. First, it was based on mass mobilization and large-scale popular participation. It was unprecedented not only in Middle East history, but also in the sheer number of participants, perhaps one of the largest in modern history. The revolutionary movement was comprehensive and decisive in ousting the old political order and dismantling its associated political and economic elites. Second, in a remarkably short time, the Islamic Revolution managed to establish a new political order, nurture a new socio-political elite, and institutionalize its hierarchy despite serious domestic and external challenges. The incipient Islamic Republic violently surpassed all other real or potential contenders. In this respect, it demonstrated a consistent drive toward greater monopoly of power. This was in common with most totalitarian regimes, intolerant of dissent even within their own ranks. War in particular greatly contributed to the Islamic Republic's grassroots support as much as to its ability to crush its opposition. Third, the Islamic Revolution offered a cultural program that included a curious mix of hardline conservatism, anti-imperialist rhetoric, selective modernity, and conscious anti-secularism. In practice, it showed no hesitation in employing modern means of repression, control, and propaganda. Nor did it show hesitation to adopt modern programs of economic development and social welfare, so long as they could be safely Islamicized. In this respect, too, despite many signs of anachronism, the Islamic Republic put into practice a program of social engineering with enduring results.